One of the arguments that's often used by Christians not to hold to and apply a larger Christian worldview is because of the claim that we live in the last days, that things are getting worse and worse. We hear about things that are going on overseas. Things are taking place in the Middle East. Supposedly the putting together of a European common market and a common currency and so forth. The wars and rumors of wars. I think Joe talked a little bit about that, and I'll probably go into Matthew 24 a little bit as well. Let me just give you a very, very quick historical perspective that doesn't go back very far. When I was in college, there was a book that came out called The Late Great Planet Earth, and it was written by Hal Lindsey. And in that particular book, Hal Lindsey said everything would be over by 1988. He said that Israel becoming a nation again in 1948 was very important to the topic of Bible prophecy, and that we could time end-time events based upon Israel being back in the land and becoming a nation again. And since that took place in 1948, we could calculate, maybe not the exact day and hour, but we could calculate in terms of, we could get pretty close to the right year. And the reason that he came to that conclusion was he took Matthew chapter 24, verse 34, and this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. And he said a generation was 40 years. And so you take 40 years plus 1948, and you get, what do you get? 1948 plus 40 years gives you 1988. Now, in case you don't know, this is 2009. So this is 21 years later that Hal Lindsey made this particular prediction based upon what he said the Bible taught, and he was, in fact, wrong. Now, he wasn't the first to do this, because before it was 1948, it was 1917 when the Balfour Declaration was implemented. And so they started calculating from 1917, and they said a generation was 40 years, and so you do 40 plus 17, and you're going to get 1957. And so when 1948, when that didn't work out again, they went to 1948, and when the 1988 didn't work out, it was when Israel took Jerusalem during the Six-Day War in 1967. Well, you add 40 to 1967, what do you get? 2007. And again, this is 2009. So you've had Christians predicting that we are going to come to some sort of prophetic eschatological end. And what do you think that does to people psychologically? What do you think people think about when they say the end is only 5 years away or 10 years away? And then we come in here and we talk about how the gospel is going to spread throughout the whole world and how we need to take the gospel to the whole world and we need to reclaim the areas of education and law and journalism and medicine and so forth, and that might take 40 or 50 or 60 years. What sort of response do you think Christians have to the kind of worldview you're being taught here when they're taught that Jesus could come back at any moment and we're living on the edge of some sort of great prophetic eschatological event? Well, I think it has an impact on people. Let me give you an example of this. The most popular position today is that we live in a prophetic parenthesis. That when Jesus came, Jesus in essence failed because the Jewish nation did not accept him as the Messiah. Now, that isn't the case, because all you have to do is read the book of Acts, and you will find out in the book of Acts that many, many Jews, thousands of Jews, tens of thousands of Jews, embraced Jesus as the promised Messiah, and that the gospel had, in fact, gone out through the entire Roman Empire during that period of time. And so this idea that the Jesus' mission to the Jews failed is just myth. God always dealt with a remnant. He dealt with a remnant of Israel in the Old Testament. He dealt with a remnant of Israel in the New Testament. So this idea that the prophetic time clock stopped and it won't start ticking again until the rapture of the church, and the rapture supposedly when Jesus is going to come back secretly and he's going to take all the Christians off the earth, and then there's going to be a 7-year tribulation period, and during that 7-year tribulation period, the temple is going to be rebuilt, Antichrist is going to be revealed, and then there's going to be Armageddon. And we're always living on this idea that Jesus could come back at any moment, and all the signs seem to be pointing to that. Well, I think, again, that affects people. I think it really does. And I've met people over the years. In fact, there was one of our board members. He's a Delta pilot. And someone had given him one of my books, Last Days Madness. And he read Last Days Madness, and he was overwhelmed with this perspective that he had never held before. He never knew anything about. And he already had three children, and he stopped having children. Of course, he continued to work at his job. But when he switched his position, he said, no, this is the biblical position. This idea that Jesus could come back at any moment, that we're living in the last days, that's really not taught in the Bible, as Joe pointed out a little bit. Well, it transformed the way he thought about things, and so he adopted two more children, and they had another child. In fact, their oldest son just got married last year, and Kent's wife walked down the aisle with their newborn baby. His perspective of the future changed so dramatically that he decided he was going to have more children. And I think this is beginning to happen with a lot of homeschool families and Christian schools, Christians in general, who have abandoned this end-time scenario of gloom and doom. They're optimistic about the future, so much so that they're having children. Now, this idea that we're living on the edge of some prophetic event has been pointed out in a number of books. Hal Lindsey wrote in 1970, The Late Great Planet Earth. Now, you think about that in 1970, that you had been told the late great planet Earth and how that would have affected you. That hasn't stopped a writer this year who has written a book called The Late Great United States. Now, there's another book, Armageddon, Oil, and the Middle East Crisis. Now, let me tell you something about this book. Armageddon, Oil, and the Middle East Crisis. Seems really current, doesn't it? And this book just came out in 2007. But the first edition came out in 1974. And then when we had the first Gulf War in 1990, this book came out again. He just revised it. And when the Gulf War was over in a flash, what happened is they were selling this book by the caseload. You could buy this book for 25 cents a copy. It was outdated again. That didn't stop them from coming out with another edition of this book in 2007. And what these prophecy writers do is they continue to revise their books or come out with new books telling everybody the end of the world is just right around the corner. And, of course, you're young enough to not to know that the late great planet Earth came out in 1970 and made all kinds of predictions. And you're young enough to know, not to know that Armageddon, Oil, and the Middle East Crisis first came out in 1974. So if you would go to the bookstore today and read the late great United States, which came out in 2009, you would think that this guy was a great prophecy writer because he was making all these predictions. But he's making the same predictions that were made in 1970 by Hal Lindsey that did not come to pass. Now, what really ramped all this up was a series of books, you might be familiar with them, called the Left Behind series by Tim LaHaye. And Tim LaHaye's position was that the church is going to be raptured, taken off the earth right before a seven-year tribulation period, and then all hell was going to break loose, the Antichrist would rise up, there'd be a rebuilt temple. You're going to be marked on your forehead and your hand with 666. There'd be more and more wars and so forth. And at the end of that period, there'd be Armageddon. And that's what most Americans believe. Some of you may believe that. I don't know. It's amazing. I go into conservative Presbyterian churches just this weekend. My own church. Is this being recorded? My own church had a set of the Left Behind series there. It's one of the most unbiblical sets of fiction books around. I wrote a book in response to it called Left Behind, Separating Fact from Fiction. Now, if you go on the website of the Left Behind website, listen to this. Are you ready for the moment of truth? Political crisis, economic crisis, worldwide epidemics, environmental catastrophe, mass disappearances, military apocalypse, and that's just the beginning of the end of the world. It's happening now. Tell others about it. Spread the word. Well, don't tell anybody else about it and don't spread it, because people have been saying the same thing for almost 2,000 years. There was a book written by Oswald J. Smith in 1926 called The Antichrist, Is He Near at Hand? And in 1926, Oswald J. Smith was trying to convince people that Mussolini was the Antichrist. Now, I don't know where you are in your history, but Mussolini was executed in 1945. And so all of these prophetic pronouncements in that particular book were just thrown away because he was wrong. He was dead wrong in all this. And then people said it was Adolf Hitler. And, of course, they were wrong about that. And people said it was Henry Kissinger. They were wrong about that. They said it was Gorbachev. They were wrong about that. Some said it was Ronald Reagan. And because Ronald has six letters, Wilson, his middle name, has six letters, and Reagan, his last name, has six letters, 666. And then he was nearly assassinated, and supposedly the Antichrist is going to come back to life again and so forth. JFK was thought to be the Antichrist because he was shot in the head and they thought he was going to come back. And because he was Roman Catholic, and for the longest time Roman Catholicism was considered to be the Antichrist, people have been just doing this over and over and over again. And not too long ago, it was Barack Obama who was the Antichrist. Now, they might be a little closer to the truth in that regard, but... So, this goes on a little further. It says, in a survey that Left Behind publisher Tyndale did, more than 50% of respondents said, I'm anxiously expecting his return. Now, I want you to think about that. You have a majority of people out there expecting Jesus to return very soon. What chance do we have as Christians in order to make effective the gospel and the Great Commission in transforming our culture, that people believe that the end is right around the corner and we really can't do anything to change anything, because this is all a prophetic inevitability. This is all prophesied in the Bible. Supposedly Russia is supposed to come down and attack Israel based upon Ezekiel 38 and 39. And all of the Mideastern nations are supposed to come in and take over Israel. And there's supposed to be a rebuilt temple. The New Testament doesn't say anything about this. The New Testament doesn't say anything about Israel becoming a nation again. The New Testament doesn't say anything about a rebuilt temple. Doesn't say anything about Russia. Doesn't say anything about anything that today you typically hear about it being the end of the world, except for wars and rumors of wars and famines and earthquakes and such, and tribulation. Well, we've always had famines and earthquakes. People talk the swine flu. They say, oh, this is a sign of the end. Well, we had the influenza at the turn of last century. And it doesn't say anything about the Black Death in the 14th century, which killed nearly a third, some say a half, of Europe. We've had all these things before. People say, well, it's the magnitude of earthquakes that we've had. That's what it is. It's how big they are and how many there are. It doesn't say anything in the Gospels about that. It simply says there will be earthquakes. There will be great earthquakes. Doesn't say there'll be more great earthquakes than ever. It says there'll simply be earthquakes. In the time between AD 30 and AD 70, which I think Joe already pointed out, there were in fact earthquakes in that period of time during that area. Famines. If you look at Acts chapter 11 says there was a famine over the entire Roman Empire. This was in the first century, right before the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And so Matthew 24, and we'll take a look at some of the rest of the chapter, is not describing things related to the end of our world. It's related to the things of their world, of their particular age, and the destruction of the temple, which took place in A.D. 70. Jan Markle, who's president of Olive Tree Ministries, she's writing for a worldview ministry. I want you to understand what makes a worldview conference like this different from almost all of the other worldview conferences out there. Because almost all of the other worldview conferences out there mix their idea of Christian worldview with the idea that we're living at the end of the world. And they turn the young people into schizophrenics. They're of two minds. We're living on the end of the world, but we're supposed to get involved in worldview ministry. Well, this is what Jan Markle, who wrote for a prominent worldview ministry that puts these things on weekends and so forth, she argues that the church is not in the business of taking anything away from Satan but the souls of men. See, all we should be concerned about is getting people saved, and that's it. And the question is, what do you do with them after they're saved? See, that's the big question that a lot of worldview ministries really can't answer. They don't have a comprehensive worldview, and they don't have a future-oriented eschatology. Now, I can assure you that the secularists have a very optimistic eschatology. Eschatology simply is the study of the last things. They have a very, very optimistic view of the future. Islam has a very, very optimistic view of the future. Islam is planning to take over the world. This is going to be your big battle. It's how when you become an adult, how your nation is going to deal with the Muslims. It has been a battle for more than 1,000 years, and the Christian West has done its very best in order to beat them back. But not anymore, because we have created this idea of religious toleration. In one sense, we don't want to persecute people because of their religion, but in this particular country, it was generally known and generally conceived that this was a Christian nation. And you came over here, you had to assimilate. It didn't mean that you had to become a Christian, but you had to abide by the basic Christian principles of this nation. They were written into our law codes and many of our own documents. Now we've given up of that particular era, and you go over to Europe right now, and England, and you'll talk to people from England, they're going to tell you that it won't be too long before England could be completely Muslim. Same thing in France and in other countries in Europe. It's because Islam has a very optimistic eschatology, and we here in the United States don't. Hal Lindsey was the fellow who wrote Late Great Planet Earth. And Late Great Planet Earth, which was written in 1970, sold in the neighborhood of about 30 million copies. Think of that. 30 million copies. The Left Behind series, which is 12 volumes plus 3 volumes of a prequel, that is what was taking place before the rapture took place in the first volume, has sold about 70 million copies. So that's 15 volumes have sold about 70 million copies. But The Late Great Planet Earth was one volume and sold about 30 million copies. So this has been going on for a long time. And some of your parents may be aware of that. But here's what Hal Lindsey said. I don't like cliches, but I've heard it said, God didn't send me to clean the fishbowl, he sent me to fish. In a way, there's truth in that. He says, look, all we should be involved in, all we should really care about, is just getting people saved. And that's what they've been all about. But let me tell you something. When it says God didn't send me to clean the fishbowl, he sent me to fish, anybody who has fish knows what. What happens if you don't clean the fishbowl? The fish die. And Christians have been, in essence, have been on the outside looking in. Now, there's another worldview ministry that, and I won't name who this person is. I don't want to embarrass them. Here's what he wrote. He has one talk that says this: socialism is here, and tyranny is to follow if we allow it. So he brings one speaker in, actually himself, he brings one speaker in and he deals with socialism, and he says, here's what we need to do. We need to oppose socialism. We need to work to oppose socialism. And if we don't do it, tyranny is to follow. So socialism is here, he says, and tyranny is to follow if we allow it. So his assumption there is it's up to us. Then he brings another speaker in. Jesus is returning in our time, the key sign, by David R. Reagan. So on the one hand, he says socialism is out there and we need to try to stop it. Then he brings another guy in and he says we're living in the last time, and Jesus is coming back in our time, and here are the signs for it. So it seems to me, why should I be bothering trying to oppose socialism if Jesus is coming back in my lifetime? It makes no sense. And so we have this ongoing schizophrenia taking place. And, of course, anti-Christians love schizophrenic Christians because it breeds broad-based spiritual passivity in the name of the Bible. You see, the reason Christians are so put to sleep by all of this stuff is because they believe the Bible actually teaches that we're living in the last days. Hal Lindsey wrote this in 1970. With optimism, with anticipation, with excitement, we should be living like persons who don't expect to be around much longer. I mean, think of that. Why bother? I mean, some of you are thinking about going off to college. Don't bother. Jesus is coming back soon. All the signs are here. Earthquakes and famines and wars and rumors of wars, tribulation, false Christs and so forth. It's all here. We're living right on the edge. Jesus is coming back real soon. Save your parents money. Don't worry about it. Don't go to college. I'm not saying you have to go to college, but don't plan for the future. Don't bother with it. And there are lots of people who, in fact, did that. Now, to show you how it's almost inevitable that they can always find something wrong in order to prove that the end is near, you have some group of prophecy writers who say it's the wars and the rumors of wars and all the bad things. That's an indication that we're living in the end times. And someone else comes along and writes a book called Peace, Prosperity, and the Coming Holocaust, and Global Peace and the Rise of Antichrist. So you've got some prophecy writers over here saying, look how bad it is, and that's a sign of the end. And then you have other prophecy writers saying, look how good it is, and that's a sign of the end. They have an answer for everything about it. It doesn't matter if there's peace in the world, well, you're setting things for the stage for the Antichrist. If things are bad in the world, well, the Antichrist must be right around the corner. So what I want to present to you today is a completely different perspective altogether. I want to present to you what I believe is a biblical way of looking at these passages. Now, Joe started you a little bit because he dealt, I guess, with hermeneutics. That's what he was dealing with, how to interpret the Bible. And when you come to prophecy passages, you have to know how to interpret the Bible. So if you have your Bible, let's go back to Matthew 24. I want to take you through the rest of the chapter of Matthew chapter 24 and then take you to a couple of more passages that are used today and to give you some ammunition. And Joe has already given you the principles, the basic principles of this. I may repeat some of these things, but that's okay because they probably need to be reinforced. Anytime you read a passage, whether it's on prophecy or anything else, the first thing you have to do is establish the context of the passage. If you don't establish the context, that is, what is the storyline that's being discussed here? What's going on? What are the questions that are being asked? I always tell people, don't memorize Bible verses. Because what ends up happening is we memorize Bible verses out of context. And you can make the Bible say anything if you memorize specific passages out of context. You always have to interpret the Bible within context. That's what the word context means. Con with text. With the text. Some of you were here last year, and maybe I used this. Judas went out and hanged himself. Go thou and do likewise. Whatever thou doest, do quickly, because there is no God. Those are four legitimate Bible verses. But because I pulled them out of their context and then put them together, I have the Bible saying something completely different. So, did Judas go out and hang himself? Yes. Did Jesus say to someone, go and do likewise? Yes, but the contexts are different. And whatever thou doest, do quickly. Is that in the Bible? Yes, but it's in a different context. And then the passage which says there is no God, well, the full context is, the fool says in his heart there is no God. So you've got to be very careful when you're studying the Bible that you understand the context of what you're reading here. And in Matthew chapter 23 is the background context for chapter 24 because Jesus is in the temple, if you look at verse 35. Verse 38. Chapter 23, behold, your house is being left to you desolate. And remember, Joe talked about in chapter 24 how the second person plural is used throughout Matthew 24. But what precedes that is chapter 23. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate. Now, at the moment, you really don't know what house he's talking to. Is he in somebody's house? Or does house mean something else? Well, we don't know right now. For I say to you, from now on you shall not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Remember, when the New Testament was initially written, there were no chapter divisions or even verse divisions. So when it says here, chapter 24, and if you have a subhead written in there, keep in mind that was never in the original Greek manuscripts. Bible chapters and Bible verses were only added to the Bible to help us figure out and to be on the same page, so to speak. So chapter 24 doesn't really exist in the original manuscripts. So let me go back to verse 38. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate. Not some future house, but their house. For I say to you, not us, but them, from now on you shall not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. I mean, Jesus couldn't be any more clear here on the audience. It's them you, not you you. And Jesus came out from the temple. You see, Jesus was in the temple when he said this. This is why his disciples came up to him and said, and he was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. And he answered and said to them, do you not see all these things? These is a plural, near demonstrative adjective. These things. If Jesus had something future in mind, he would have said those things. But he said these things. Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here shall be left upon another which will not be torn down. He was talking about the temple that was right there that they saw. This was Herod's rebuilt temple. You know, this is another thing. You'll find lots of modern-day prophecy writers who say, oh, the temple has to be rebuilt. That's a requirement. The temple has to be rebuilt. And I'll say, show me the New Testament that says anything about a rebuilt temple. There is not a single word in the entire New Testament that says anything about a rebuilt temple. Nothing. And if someone challenges on this, you bet them $100, and if they find you a passage that says that the temple is going to be rebuilt, you tell me, and I'll give you, you can give them the $100, and I'll give you $200. Now, don't let them fool you into saying, well, verse 24, when the abomination... Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, and they'll say, well, see, the abomination of desolation has to take its place in the temple, so this has to be a rebuilt temple. First of all, it doesn't say this is a rebuilt temple. Second of all, this passage was written prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. The temple was still standing. This is the temple that it's referring to. Notice the second person plural there, when you see the abomination of desolation. Or they'll go to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, and they'll talk about the man of lawlessness who has to take his seat in the temple. And they'll say, that has to be a rebuilt temple because that hasn't taken place yet. Doesn't say it's a rebuilt temple. It was that book was written prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. That's the temple Paul was talking about. Well, in Revelation chapter 11, it says there's the temple is mentioned there. And I said, absolutely it is. And notice that John is told to measure the temple, and it was the temple that was in Jerusalem, and there's still worshipers in it. And since the book of Revelation was written prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, it refers to that temple. There isn't a single verse in the New Testament that says anything about a rebuilt temple. Nothing, not word one. So I say, well, the Old Testament talks about a rebuilt temple. Well, it does. And in fact, the temple was rebuilt. After the Jews came back from exile, what was one of the first things that they had to do? They had to rebuild the temple. And then it fell into disarray during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, and then Herod was in the process of rebuilding the temple. And this is the temple that Jesus is talking about here. So the context of this is that audience, you, and that particular temple. No other temple. And since Joe has already gone down to, I think to verse 15, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place. And if you go, and keep in mind, one of the other principles, not only is it context and audience and word study as well. If you look at verse 14, that word world there is oikomene, and you find that in Luke 2:1 and Acts chapter 11. And the gospel had, in fact, been preached throughout the whole oikomene during that period of time. But one of the other things that you have to also be aware of here are parallel accounts. Luke and Mark parallel Matthew chapter 24. And so you look at Luke, and Luke says it a little differently. He's talking about the same event. Look at verse 16. You'll see that this is a local event and not a worldwide event. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to get the things out that are in his house. This is only talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And in order to escape this, how far do you have to go? Just leave the city and go to the mountains. That's it. If this were worldwide, there'd be no escape from it. This is talking about a very narrow slice of history, and it's talking about something that would take place before that particular generation passed away. Notice the locale of it. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to get the things out that are in his house. When's the last time you were on your roof and your parents said, "Come on, we got to go," and you left the roof and you went down and you got, you know, your backpack or a sweater or something? Never. Why? Because we don't have houses like that, and hardly anybody does. But in Jerusalem, they did. Pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on a Sabbath. They had very strict Sabbath laws back then. It was something called a Sabbath day's journey. You can only travel so far on the Sabbath. That wouldn't stop any of us here in the United States or anywhere else in the world. It makes no sense except in a pre-AD 70 time period. For then there will be great tribulation such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. This was, in fact, the greatest tribulation that the Jews as a covenant people ever experienced. They lost everything. Outside of Christ, they lost everything. They lost their priesthood, they lost the ability for animal sacrifices, and they lost their temple. They lost their land, they lost their heritage, they lost their identity. This was the greatest tribulation. Remember the audience. It's them, not you. They are the subjects of this. It was their greatest tribulation. What took place in the Holocaust was a terrible, terrible thing, but it has nothing to do covenantally with what's going on here. The question of the day was the temple, the destruction of the temple. Not one stone here will be left upon another. Jesus isn't talking about something that would take place in the distant future. Some of these other ones are pretty common, false Christ and so forth. If you go down here, verse 29. Verses 29 through 31 really throw people somewhat because they seem to say, "But boy, this has to refer to something in the distant future." In fact, one particular Bible commentator, D.A. Carson, and D.A. Carson is a fine, fine Bible commentator. And everything up through verse 28, D.A. Carson says, refers to the destruction of Jerusalem in A.D. 70, which I would agree. He even says, verse 34, "Truly I say to you, let's go look at verse 33, even so you too," remember, them you, not you you, "even so you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is at the door, is near, right at the door." When who sees all these things? When they see all these things, his present audience. Now look at verse 34. "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place." That's a near demonstrative again. This generation. And how do people get around this? Oh, they say, "Oh, it's the generation that will see these signs that won't pass away." It's not what it says. People argue with you on this text. You say to them, "What does the text say?" It's this generation will not pass away. And then you take them back and look at other passages which say this generation. And every time, I debated Tommy Ice once. Well, actually, I debated him 9 times. And Tommy Ice said, every time this generation is used in the Gospels, it always refers to the generation to whom Jesus is speaking, except here. Now, if our roles were reversed, and I came across a passage that 20-some times it's used one way, but here it's used some other way, he'd laugh at me. He'd say, "It's just typical of you, you know, you have a position you have to defend, and you just don't want to let loose of it." Well, he says, every other time this generation is used in the Gospels, it always refers to the generation to whom Jesus is speaking, which it does. It does here, too. He even admits that it means the same thing up in chapter 23, verse 36. "Truly I say to you, all these things shall come upon this generation." He says it refers to that particular generation. If Jesus had a future generation in mind, he would have said, "Truly I say to you, that generation will not pass away until all these things take place." So D.A. Carson agrees with my interpretation of verse 34. He agrees with everything I say up through verse 28. He says that all refers to the destruction of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. Then he gets to verses 29, 30, and 31 and says this refers to what we call, described today as the second coming. I don't agree with him at all. First of all, verse 34 tells us this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. And since verses 29, 30, and 31 are before verse 34, those things have to be included. So here's the next principle of interpreting the Bible, and that is compare Scripture with Scripture. Verse 29, but immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And so I don't know what version of the Bible you have, but I have a New American Standard. And what it does in the New American Standard, it takes quotations from the Old Testament and puts them in small capital letters. So it's telling me this is a direct quotation from the Old Testament. Now, you may have a Bible that has maybe a little note taking you to a passage, say, Isaiah chapter 13. And this is a quotation from Isaiah chapter 13. So what you have to do is go back to Isaiah chapter 13. When you go back to Isaiah chapter 13, you'll see in Isaiah 13 that this is descriptive language of the fall of Babylon, Old Covenant, Old Testament Babylon. Verse 6, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. There's a time text. This is describing something that was near in Isaiah's day. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will fall limp. And every man's heart will melt, and they will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. This language is very, very similar to what you find in Matthew chapter 24. They will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation. And he will exterminate its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it arises, and the moon will not shed its light. And Jesus takes that Babylonian apocalyptic language that applied to the destruction of Babylon centuries ago, and he applies it to New Testament Babylon, which is Israel. And he says, you're just like this Babylon of old. Your idol worshiping and so forth. And so this isn't talking about the sun actually going dark and the moon and so forth and stars falling from heaven. This is descriptive language of a nation under judgment. Now, how do we know this? Am I just guessing? Am I trying to make it fit? No, because I went back to Isaiah chapter 13, and when I saw in Isaiah 13, they took that same language to describe the destruction of Babylon. I have to go with what Scripture says, how this type of text is used. In fact, I went and checked Bible commentaries on all this, and all the Bible commentaries say that language in Isaiah chapter 13 is typical language for the destruction of nations. But there's more. Remember, Joseph had two dreams in the book of Genesis. In Genesis chapter 37, he had a dream of what? What bowed down to him? What bowed down to Joseph? Do you remember? The sun, the moon, and 11 stars. Now, what was that all about? Who did the sun represent? His father. Who did the moon represent? His mother. Who did the 11 stars represent? His brothers. Israel. Then you go into the book of Revelation, and there's this vision of this woman who stands on the moon, who's draped with the sun, and has 12 stars as a crown. What does that represent? Israel again. Even Tim LaHaye, who's the author of Left Behind, says that that's a depiction of Israel. Well, see, sun, moon, and stars here. What Jesus is doing, he's pulling together the judgment of Babylon, and he's taking this imagery of Israel, which is what this is all about with the destruction of the temple, and he is saying, this is what is going to happen to your nation and your temple within this generation. And, of course, as history bears out, the temple was in fact destroyed in A.D. 70. Not one stone was left upon another. If in fact you go to Israel today, you won't see a stone anywhere. So this prophecy was fulfilled just like Jesus said. Now, this is important before we go on to this next verse, because liberals have used this particular prophecy here to try to prove that Jesus was wrong and therefore you can't trust the Bible. Jesus said he would come back before that generation. And of course, the dispensation said, well, no, it seems like Jesus was saying that, but really, he meant this. It's not this generation will not pass away. It could mean this race will not pass away, or it's the generation that sees these signs won't pass away, or this nation won't pass away. That's nonsense. You read it just the way it is. It says this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. So Bertrand Russell, who was an atheist at the beginning part of the 20th century, he came out and wrote a book, Why I Am Not a Christian. And he looked at this particular passage, plus a couple of other passages in Matthew's gospel, and says, Jesus was mistaken. He said he was going to come back before a generation, and he didn't. Yes, he did. He came back in judgment just like he said he would. Just like God came against Babylon in Isaiah chapter 19, when it says that God came on the clouds to Egypt, and all the idols trembled at his presence. Or read Micah chapter 1, where it says, God came down and stepped on the high places of the earth, and the mountains melted under him. This idea of coming language isn't always an indication of the second coming. And so Bertrand Russell really was never answered by those who claim this is still in the future. Now, there's a new guy who's on the scene today. His name is Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman wrote a book called Misquoting Jesus. And Bart Ehrman is traveling all over the country criticizing the Bible. And he says one of the reasons he left the Christian faith was because he read Hal Lindsey and first believed that. But as he did more study on the New Testament, he says Jesus was wrong in Matthew chapter 24 on the Olivet Discourse. And it's obvious that Bart Ehrman, who claims to be a New Testament scholar, hasn't done much study in the New Testament. Because the position that we're advocating here is an old position that goes back, well, all the way back to the early church fathers. This is an old, old position. Matthew Henry taught it. Thomas Scott taught it. John Gill and John Lightfoot, who was at the Westminster Confession, who was at the Westminster Assembly. This is an old, old position. The position that you hear today is a relatively new position that didn't really come on the scene until about the 19th century. You can trust the Bible. Everything Jesus said in Matthew chapter 24 took place before that particular generation passed away. Now look at verse 30. It says, and then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the land will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. You say, well, you can't believe that that's already happened. Yes, I do. I believe that that happened. I believe it happened because verse 34 tells me, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. And verse 30 is one of the things that is mentioned before verse 34. Now, part of the problem here is translation. If you know anything about Greek, sometimes the word heaven is used. If look at verse 29. It says, and then the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Now, the Greek word there for heavens is the plural uranos. All right? So, the Greek word, if someone had a Greek New Testament here, if you looked that up, it would have uranos. And look at verse 30. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the uranos. It's the same Greek word. It's in heaven. Not in the sky, but in heaven. And then all the tribes of the land, that is the land of Israel, will mourn. Same with the word geis or gay in Greek can be translated as dirt, land, or earth. It's more appropriate here to be the land because the tribes refer to the tribes of Israel. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now, this is another passage that's a direct quotation from the Old Testament. Does your Bible have a little cross-reference to tell you what verse this comes from? Where in the Old Testament is Jesus pulling this particular scripture passage? Don't know? That's right. Look at Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. I want you to notice the direction of the Son of Man. which way is the Son of Man going? In Daniel 7:13, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a Son of Man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. So what's Jesus saying here? He's saying, I'm the Son of Man, and you're going to see the Son of Man going up on the clouds of heaven. They knew he was referring to Daniel. So they're looking and say, this is the Son of Man that Daniel is talking about? This is his enthronement. Did Jesus go up on a cloud to heaven? Is there a place in the New Testament where it says Jesus went up on a cloud to heaven? Where? Okay, and also in the book of Acts. Remember in the very first chapter of Acts, Jesus is taken up and his disciples are looking up and the angel says, why are you looking up? Jesus will return in the same way that he went up. So Jesus goes up into heaven, and what does he do when he gets to heaven? What does the New Testament say Jesus does when he gets to heaven? He says he takes his seat and he sits at the Father's right hand. And that's what Acts 2 is all about. He sits on David's throne. So this particular passage isn't referring to some future coming of Christ down to earth. This is the coming of Christ up to his Father taking his seat. Now I want you to go a little bit further here and look at Matthew chapter 26. And Jesus is before Caiaphas. He's the high priest. Jesus, this is a fiasco of a trial. They're lying against Jesus and so forth. That he's there for a very specific purpose. He must die on the cross. Verse 62 says, and the high priest stood up and said to him, do you make no answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you? But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God. Are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of God? Now, instead of Jesus just saying yes, he goes back to the Old Testament and he quotes a particular passage. Verse 64, Jesus said to him, you have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter, actually, from now on, you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Now, notice what Caiaphas does next. Then the high priest tore his robe, saying, he has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you have now heard the blasphemy. Caiaphas knew exactly what Jesus was saying. I'm the Son of Man of Daniel chapter 7. I will ascend to the Father, and I will sit at his right hand. I will sit at the right hand of the Ancient of Days. He knew what he meant. And I'm convinced by this is that Caiaphas actually had a direct line shot for the Mount of Olives when Jesus ascended to heaven, and that he actually saw Jesus ascend just like the disciples did. That's what Matthew 24 is all about. And then he says here that he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. This is the gospel. The gospel going out through all of Israel. As Matthew chapter 10:23 states. Remember Matthew 10:23? You will not finish going through the cities of Israel until the Son of Man comes. Then it says, now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branches have already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Even so, you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near right at the door. And then truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. So Matthew chapter 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21 are not describing events at the end of history. They are describing events at the end of that particular age, that is the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. This was prophecy when it was given, but it is now fulfilled prophecy. And we can look at this and say everything Jesus said that he would do, he in fact did. So all these modern-day prophecy writers are taking all these passages and they keep applying them to their generation, and each time they do, they have egg on their face and they're embarrassed. No, they're not embarrassed. They just go and write another prophecy book. Now, they just wait for a new crop of people to come up here and they buy their prophecy books. They've been saying the same thing for years. And so you can trust the Bible when it speaks of these particular things. We don't have time to go through the book of Revelation on all this, obviously, but the book of Revelation is about that period of time as well. The book of Revelation was written, it says these things must shortly take place, the time is near. The temple is still standing, Revelation chapter 11. We know that at the end of the book of Revelation, the time is near, chapter 22, and Jesus says, I'm coming quickly. And one of the things Jesus says in Revelation chapter 22, do not seal up the prophecy. Don't seal it up. And you go back to Daniel. Daniel is told to seal up the prophecy. Why? Because I believe that the breaking of the scrolls in the book of Revelation is actually part of Daniel's prophecy. But because this wasn't to take place for another 600 years or so, Daniel is told to seal it up. Until Messiah the Prince comes, which is Jesus, he was supposed to seal it up. And the book of Revelation is the breaking of that seal, and that book is opened, and that's why John is told not to seal up the prophecy, for the time is near, he said. See, this all fits. It all fits hand in glove. You can trust the Bible on all this. Now, what effect does this have? The effect has in saying, wow, all these prophecies, people keep saying how bad things are going to get. I'm not saying things aren't going to get bad. I'm not saying there isn't going to be tribulation. There are Christians around the world who are being martyred for their faith. But it does demonstrate that these passages here are not talking about the end of the world. Now, let me close with a little story. It's about a Romanian pastor. I thought I had this here. Yeah, I do. A Romanian pastor, and his name was Joseph Zahn. Now, he lived under a communist regime in Romania. I mean, Romania was officially communistic. I want you to think about that. Officially communistic. You could not have a meeting like this. We would all be arrested. Joe and I would be executed. Gary would be, you'd be gone. You'd be put in some prison somewhere. That isn't happening here. We have tens of millions of Christians in the United States. We have nothing to bellyache about. We still have the right to vote. We have the right to the freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom to of a redress of grievances to the national government. We have all those freedoms. We have no excuses. And so when you hear something like what Joseph Zahn went through and the optimism that he had, in the light of all of the bad things that were happening in his culture, we ought to be ashamed of ourselves as a nation. He starts off by saying, it shouldn't be necessary to speak about the importance of understanding the times, but let me remind you of that great insight that we find in 1 Chronicles 12:32 in the description of the 200 men of the tribe of Issachar who understood the times and because of that understanding of history were able to tell Israel what to do. The sons of Issachar who understood the times so that they would know what Israel should do. And he goes on, he talks about here in the United States what we need to understand. Remember, this is a man who lived under communism, official atheism. Let me illustrate the importance of understanding the times from my own experience. The communist disaster fell on my country when I was a teenager. For many years after that, my life was a battle for intellectual and spiritual survival under Marxist indoctrination and totalitarian anti-Christian terror. I struggled to understand the nature of that calamity, and the Lord gave me that understanding. In the 1940s, I wrote papers on the nature of the failure of communism. One of them, published under the title The Christian Manifesto, landed me in 6 months of house arrest with harsh interrogations by the secret police. But for me, the crucial moment came in 1977 when a friend of mine challenged me to set up an organization that would openly expose communism. Here's what I told him. Communism is an experiment that has failed. It wasn't able to fulfill any of its many promises, and nobody believes in it anymore, except on college campuses like this one. Because of this, it will one day collapse on its own. Now, why should I fight something that is finished? I believe that our task is a different one. When communism collapses, somebody has to be there to rebuild society. I believe our job as Christian teachers is to train leaders so that they will be ready and capable to rebuild our society on a Christian basis. That's what a conference like this is all about. To my surprise, here is what my friend said to me. Joseph, you are wrong. Communism will triumph all over the world because this is the movement of the Antichrist. And when the communists take over in the United States, they will have no restraining force left. They will then kill all the Christians. We only have one job to do, to alert the world and make ready to die. See, that's what this end time eschatology does. It disables people. They can't move. Studies have been done. They take groups of people and they say 10% of people panic in a crisis. They panic. They go around screaming and so forth, and they're absolutely useless. 80% of them stand there and wonder and don't know what to do, and it's only 10% of them that actually can respond under pressure and immediately move in and do something. It's the 10-10-80 proposition. The sons of Issachar were the 10% who understood what to do. And what will that 10% do? It will lead the 80%, the muddled middle. But you can't do that if you don't have a mindset for it and if you're not trained for it. So a few years later, my friend was forced to leave Romania. He came to the U.S. and settled down. Then I was forced into exile, and I moved to the U.S. as well. In fact, I met Joseph Zahn's daughter up in Oregon at a conference. I was shocked. She said, "Oh, Joseph Zahn's my father," after I had also talked about this. He came to the U.S. and settled down. Then I was forced into exile, and I moved to the U.S. He says, "Since then, my friend has not done anything for Romania. He simply waited for the final triumph of communism and the annihilation of Christianity. On the other hand, when I came here in 1981, I started a training program for Christian leaders in Romania. We translated Christian textbooks and smuggled them into Romania. With our partners in the organization, the Biblical Education by Extension, we trained about 1,200 people all over Romania. Today, those people who were trained in that underground operation are the leaders in churches and evangelical denominations and in key Christian ministries. You see, the way you look to the future determines your planning and your actions. It is the way you understand the times that determines what you are going to do. You understand the times. We understand the times. We don't allow the times to dictate for us what the Bible says. We go to the Bible to determine how to understand the times and how we are to react to them. And that's what this conference is all about, to prepare you for that. You've got to get the mindset for it, and you've got to get the knowledge for it and the commitment for it, because we may end up like Joseph Zahn. But even if we do, if we're put under house arrest, you write your Christian manifesto, because whoever puts us under house arrest will one day collapse. Their worldview will collapse. I'm hoping if enough of us finally get the vision of all this, we can throw the bums out. Throw them out now. Thank you.